5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
The Omaha Steaks End of Season Sale is here to deliver everything you crave to reset after the holidays. From handcrafted USDA-certified tender steaks to gourmet burgers, versatile chicken and pork, and more, no matter what you order, you'll know exactly what you're getting. Premium, lean protein that everyone loves. And right now, get 50% off site-wide at omahasteaks.com. Plus, get an extra $35 off with promo code AUDIO at checkout. Omaha Steaks has delivered high-quality steaks and other proteins for over a century. Ideal for when you want something delicious, and every bite is backed by their 100% satisfaction guarantee. Reset after the busy holiday season with the exceptional taste of Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com for 50% off site-wide during their end-of-season sale. And for an extra $35 off, use promo code AUDIO at checkout. That's omahasteaks.com. Terms apply. See site for details.
There is a tendency, I think, on the right to over emphasize biological differences in order to sustain very strongly gendered divisions of labor or gendered divisions in the labor market and so on. The right make the mistake of taking differences at the average, which are true, and using them to say, and that's why men do X, women do Y.
Welcome, viewers and listeners. I'm Mona Charon, syndicated columnist and policy editor at The Bulwark. I'm delighted to welcome Richard Reeves today as my guest. Richard has written an excellent book called Of Boys and Men, and also founded the American Institute for Boys and Men. And there's a lot to discuss here. It's a topic of intense interest to me. And so before we get rolling, I'd just like to begin by asking Richard, what was the impetus for writing this book? You've done some videos and interviews where you said you got a little bit of skepticism on the part of some people when you mentioned this topic idea. What propelled you to examine the subject and write about it?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you very much for having me on. I'm really looking forward to this. I'm a big fan of your work. Well, I've spent a lot of time studying issues around inequality and opportunity, mobility in education. You know, I've done a lot of work on that. And I just kept running across the data points where it was really boys and men who we needed to be most worried about. I mean, and I think what was happening was that you'd see the data point and say, oh, that's interesting, and then move on, because it didn't fit with the narrative, right? The narrative mm-hmm. that it could be boys and men who are the ones who are behind just doesn't fit very well. But it kept accumulating that evidence. And then my boys are all grown now, but I've raised three sons, and you know, they were teenagers by the time I started working on this project, and we'd be talking about stuff over the dinner table and some of the experiences they were having. And I'm not suggesting for a moment that they were the boys who are most disadvantaged, but nonetheless, I came to really feel like this was important work. And to some extent, the more I was warned about the dangers of writing about the topic, the more important I thought it was for someone like me to write about it, because I thought it felt like a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy that if somehow people with charts and at the Brookings Institution where I then was aren't allowed to talk about this, because somehow that will mean that they're, you know, this is somehow a risky subject to take on. The more I thought, well, and that means that the only people who are talking about it, you know, perhaps will be, you know, not representative, if you like. And so it made me a bit more determined in some ways to go through with it. And to try and have just an evidence-based, good faith conversation about some facts that I thought, no matter how inconvenient they are nonetheless facts.
So I think it might be on the very first page of your book, you describe the gender gap in education. You say it is wider now than it was in 1972 when Congress passed Title IX to create more opportunities for girls and women. And it's wider now, but in the other direction, right?
That's right. On college campuses, that's true. Yeah, that we're nearly 60-40 now, female, male, on college campuses. And that's about this. That's a little bit wider than we had in the early 70s, but the other way around. And so it has been a really remarkable and quite rapid reversal. And it's hard, I think, for people to get their head around that, particularly if you're perhaps a little bit older. I remember trying to explain
to my... And therefore used to thinking of girls as the ones who are facing
behind.
All the challenges.
Yeah,
yes.
And so like if you will quite rightly get many women who, in their 50s or more say, well, I remember, universities were against women and I remember the professors wouldn't call on the women. They have an experience of gender equality that was real, but that has been very rapidly not only overcome, but in many ways reversed. And I think it's a human challenge to update our own experience with the new data. And I think that's a real issue in higher education, has been to kind of recognize that to the extent that there is a problem of gender inequality in higher education in the US now, it is that men are behind women. And that's just a really difficult switch for people to make when it's changed so quickly.
And in fact, it's representative of a switch that starts in the earliest grades, right? Girls are outperforming boys from kindergarten right through the whole educational experience, right?
Yeah, yeah. So in some ways, it's interesting that it becomes most salient and perhaps most talked about when we get to college. And I think part of the reason for that is because you can see it in just the men aren't there.
Right.
To some extent, it becomes physical. You can look around campuses, and sort of go, where are the men?
The campuses would be even more lopsided if it weren't for the silent affirmative action that they have been performing over the last several decades of lowering standards for men.
That's true, but and I make a point of that in the book, that's really mostly true of the highly selective colleges who are doing that. Actually, the publics generally don't do that, which I think is probably why the gender gaps are bigger at the publics than at these kind of more elite privates. And like to some extent, like what's happening in colleges, it reflects what's happened, as you said, like all the way from K through 12. It's just that generally speaking, the boys are still there. They're in the classroom by and large.
So
it doesn't feel as existential to see these huge gaps. Like in high school, for example, the top 10% of high school students measured by GPA, if you take that top 10%, two thirds of them are girls. Right. So you've got twice as many girls as boys in that top 10%. And in the bottom 10%, it's the other way around. And so, but that's perhaps not as obvious in high school because the boys, even if they're underperforming, they're still there. Whereas suddenly you get to college and it's like, well, they're not here. Or if they are, they're more likely to drop out. So it becomes more visible and therefore a bit more existential in higher education. But honestly, it's been building.
Yeah. And it's even more stark for African Americans. I think you talk about this a fair amount in your book as well. You know that I just came across a statistic the other day that something like 66% of BAs go to Black women. That's just, that's
compared to
huge,
Black men.
Huge, compared with Black men, right.
Yeah.
And so it becomes more difficult for those Black women college graduates to find equivalent men of the same education level to marry. So that becomes a cycle that's not necessarily very healthy. But let's talk also about where men are. So we've talked about education a little bit. They're lagging in education. They're also lagging in labor force participation, mental health. So sketch us the picture of how men are doing these days.
Yeah, so it starts in education. So that was a good place for us to start, where we see these big, big gender gaps. But then there might be a world where you say, well, it doesn't matter if men aren't doing as well in education because they don't need it. They're still going to do much better in work and in earnings and so on too. But that is not true. As you said, we've seen declining labor force participation among men, and especially among men without a college degree. And so there's this big class divide where we're seeing kind of declining shares of men in employment. And it's important, I think, to state the difference between level and trend. And so with a lot of these things, it's not that we're saying that that men are now less likely to work than women, although in some cases that is true for men, for example, for lower income men, men from very low income backgrounds, and for black men. It may well be true, but generally speaking, it's still true that men are working less. Men are still working, more likely to be working than women. But when they're not working, it's not for the same reasons that women are not working, right? And so,
yeah, talk about that.
You're not comparing apples with apples at that point, right? So the main reason why women, and by the way, women's labor force participation is at the highest level ever, and going up, and men's is going down. So even if the lines haven't crossed, we're seeing very different trends. But then secondly, it's like the main reason women are not in paid work, I should say, is because they're caring for others, usually children.
Right.
That is not true for men. And you actually see that men who are out of the labor force are less likely to be living with children than those who are in the labor force. Right. And so it is absolutely not the case that they're not in work because they're raising the kids.
Right.
Say, right. That would be a very different world. And we might be not only not worried about it, we might in some ways be celebrating it.
Right? Sure.
That's not true. And in fact, half of the men without a college degree who are not working say that it's because they're disabled or unwell, sick in some way. And a lot of that is now mental health. A lot of that is addiction. Substance abuse disorders, etc. And so what we're seeing is that as many are really struggling in the education system, that is translating for many of them into struggles in the world of work, which in turn translates into difficulties around family formation, parenting, etc. And so you can create a downward spiral quite quickly here. And then when boys don't have dads in their lives or engaged in their lives in a strong way, it also turns out that boys are more sensitive to family disadvantage and particularly to the lack of a father. And so what that means is that you create an intergenerational cycle of male disadvantage where the struggles of one generation of men actually become the difficult starting conditions for another generation of men. And that seems to be a really big part of the problem.
Right. And now it's always been the case that men have gotten into trouble with the law more than women and had higher rates of substance abuse. But it has gotten worse, right, in recent decades.
Yes, it has. You're right to point out that there's always been a gender gap. But the levels have risen on many of these fronts much more for men than for women. Which is not to say, and it is an important point that I think we both assumed that your viewers and listeners will understand, that we're not saying there aren't still very many challenges for women, or in any way to say it isn't also a challenge for women. But if we just take something like deaths from drug poisoning, this century, we've seen a huge rise for men. We've seen a modest rise for women too, but the rise for men has been off the charts to the extent that this is some work that the American Institute for Boys and Men just did, which is looking at if drug poisoning deaths for men had remained at the 2001 level, they'd just been flat. So still seeing deaths from drug poisonings, but just at the 2001 level. If that had remained the case, how many fewer men would have died than have died because of the massive increase? And the answer is 400,000 men. So we've lost an additional 400,000 men as a result of the rise in drug poisoning, which, to put a sharp point in it, is about the number of men we lost in World War II.
Yeah.
So we've lost the equivalent of a world's war's worth of men as a result of the rise in drug poisoning just since 2001. Now, these are numbers and problems that it is irresponsible for anybody, regardless of their politics, to look away from.
Yeah. And when you look at these social problems through the lens of looking at it, how is it affecting men versus women? It gives you greater insight, I think, because, you know, there is this sort of facile tendency to say, oh, you know, we have more drug overdose deaths. It's because of fentanyl. Well, yes, fentanyl is a very, you know, drug that's very easy to overdose on, more even than heroin. But when you look at the differences in sex vulnerability, you realize there has to be more going on than just the power of the drug itself. Otherwise, you'd see more women as well dying from fentanyl.
Exactly. And I'm so glad you raised that, because I was just looking at a very interesting new study, which is showing that the male death rates from exactly those sorts of drugs you've talked about, opioids, heroin, etc., that they're much higher, even conditional on using them, than women's, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so there's something quite gendered about the way in which men in particular will be using or abusing these drugs compared to women. So even you take, say, a man and a woman who both have used these substances, the man is much more likely to die. And so yeah. I think that gets us into holes, and there's some biology there for sure. But interestingly, one of the things the study finds is that the men who are using those drugs are much more likely to be alone.
Yep.
And so if they do go into, if they do overdose or they do have some problem, there isn't anyone there to revive them. And so actually that then speaks to why you're taking the drugs, the social environment, the setting. And I think that these sorts of drugs are really drugs of retreat. They're drugs of despair, if you like. Mm-hmm. And you just see that that's more likely to be the reason that men are taking them. And so that's where a gender lens is useful.
So you said something a second ago that I want to spend a good deal of time on, namely the greater vulnerability that boys have growing up in fractured families versus girls. Very important, I think. But before we get there, I'd like you to talk for a bit about, you have chapters in your book where you talk about what you regard as the mistake. People look at these data and they look at the gender gaps, and the left makes its share of mistakes in interpretation and the right makes its share. So let's talk first about the left. What is it that you think they miss or misinterpret?
Yeah, I think one big mistake on the left is to automatically ascribe any differences that you see in outcomes between the genders, where men are a disadvantage as a result of socialization, right? And to deny any role at all for biologically rooted differences in outcomes for men and for women. And I think that's a form of almost like a science denialism, if I can put mm-hmm. it that strongly, because I just think that it's very hard not to look at some of these pieces of evidence and say, look, there's something going on here that cannot be explained just through socialization. I think that's a big mistake.
Can I interrupt for one quick second? Because I've gotten this a lot in the feedback mm-hmm. to my own work. There is a fear on the part of many people on the left, I would say, that if you ascribe something to biology, that this will automatically mean that women are regarded as inferior to men.
Right. Yes.
Right. And in fact, even if you are honest about biology, there are many ways in which women are superior to men. So there's no necessary implication that biology means female inferiority.
No, in fact, you're quite right. If anything, it would probably point the other way now, particularly in terms of health issues and life expectancy.
Longevity.
Yeah. I mean, which is
resilience.
The gender gap's just gotten much bigger in life expectancy. And you're right. But I think it's important to understand where that comes from, right? It's from a perfectly understandable fear.
Right, right.
Right, because that is historically how discussions of sex differences have very often ended. They have not ended well for women, typically.
That's true.
And so when I talk about these sorts of issues, I find it very useful to just sort of pause and say, look, I totally get that, right? That's a perfectly legitimate reaction. But then say, okay, but it's not where we should stay, because that's not necessarily how it's going to be used now. And that at a certain point, to continue, for even for understandable reasons, to deny any sex differences based on kind of biology doesn't serve anybody very well, not least because it's just not true. It doesn't feel true to anybody mm-hmm. outside of the small group of people, right? I mean, actually, right. one of my a very good new book that's come out since mine came out is by Ruth Whipman, and it's called Boy Mom, which I've reviewed, and I certainly don't agree with Ruth about everything, but it's very interesting because she's a feminist, and she comes to this idea, and she raises boys, she comes to this idea that all differences are socialized, right? Because that's her feminist training, and as the main socializer, she feels like therefore it's her. And so when her boys start acting in a certain way, she feels trapped and blamed. And it's like, well, it can't be anything about their biology, right? And then she eventually comes to realize that, you know what, it is. And it's just crazy at a certain level to deny that entirely. But so in other words, the fear of that biological difference being weaponized or overdetermined leads people to deny that it's there at all. Mm-hmm. And that's just, it doesn't feel true because it's not true. And it just gets in the way of a more productive conversation. So I think it's a big one. The second one that I really think the left has gotten wrong more recently especially has been to talk about masculinity as somehow toxic. I think that the term toxic masculinity, which really only was invented in 2016, not coincidentally, I mean, not invented, but that's when it became used more generally, because it betrays a bit of a reflex, I think, to suggest that if boys and men are struggling, it's somehow their fault, and it oddly individualizes the problem, which is something the left typically tries not to do. Typically, mm-hmm. the left is more interested in structural explanations, systemic explanations. But when it comes to men, there's very often a kind of reflex of saying, well, what's wrong with them, right? It's they need to fix themselves, and perhaps if they weren't so toxic. And so I think that's been a very unfortunate turn in the way in which progressives have been defining this, which is to make masculinity itself seem almost pathological, toxic, and therefore to individualize the problem, and effectively to say men can't have problems because men are the problem. And I think that that litany of mistakes that the left has made on issues around boys and men has been very unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else on the left that you think is problematic before we turn to the other side?
I think those are the main ones. I think that this is something that perhaps spans left and right, but I think that the framing this as zero sum, in other words, that to advocate for some of the issues around boys and men, to spend resources on issues for boys and men, is somehow to mean that you have to do less for women and girls, that somehow you care less about women and girls. And actually, that has been an issue. So I think the zero-sum frame on this issue has been particularly bad on the left, because, you know, trying to persuade people drawing attention to the problems of boys in school doesn't mean you have to pay less attention to the issues around women in politics or
the gender pay gap. And it doesn't mean, does it, that you want to return society to 1950 standards?
Well, that's
the
right.
The other thing that always comes up.
So now we're coming on to the right, I think, which is that's the
challenge
on the right.
Well, actually, both. So, but on the one hand, the left objects, if you raise the problems of boys, they say, well, then you're endorsing the patriarchy, right? You just want to return to the 1950s. But now let's go to the right. What are the mistakes that they make?
You're right. You can do that different. Well, but so some of these mistakes are the mirror images of those that are made on the left. And so the first is there is a tendency, I think, on the right to overemphasize biological differences in order to sustain very strongly gendered divisions of labor or gendered divisions in the labor market and so on. And so, for example, you'll get conservative commentators, and I mentioned some of them in the book, saying, well, look, you're never going to get very many women engineers because women are more interested in, you know, things rather than people rather than things, right? There is this difference on the average in the kind of interests and preferences between men and women. But that comment has been used to justify only 5% of engineers being women, whereas I think it's a very plausible reason why you might not get 50% of engineers being women. but it gets nowhere near explaining why it would be as low as 5%, or why only 3% of early years educators are men, right? Because what it's basically saying is the right make the mistake of taking differences at the average, which are true, and using them to say, and that's why men do X, women do Y, and why women mm-hmm. won't do X, Y. You know? So in other words, it's what economists call statistical discrimination. And mm-hmm. I just like, actually, you know, my sister-in-law is an engineer and my son is an elementary school teacher, right? So please don't tell me that women can't be engineers and men can't teach, right? Of right. course, at the average, you might see more. So that's one yeah. big mistake they make. And I think the second one is this kind of, is this sense of wanting to go back to a script which I think is now unattainable, even if we wanted it back, which is of the male breadwinner, single male breadwinner family, and a very clear gender division of labor. Now, the nice thing about that world was that it was, people had very clear roles, very clear scripts. Families, partly as a result, were generally pretty stable. I think that those family settings were pretty good for kids on average, right? I'm saying all the good things about that. But we're not going to go back to a world where the family rests upon the economic dependence of women on men. We are not, and in my view, should not try to go back to that world. Women's economic independence is now a fact, and a fact that in my view we should celebrate, and which has profound consequences for the way we think about family life and fatherhood and motherhood. So there is no wishing our way back to a world where men can feel clear in their roles and their purpose because of their economic superiority to women. And I think sometimes on the right, you get this feeling or this sense, this argument that the way forward is to go back. And I think that's both unrealistic and, in my view, undesirable.
There is also a global phenomenon. Certainly it is noticeable in some Latin American countries, in the US and in Europe, where this kind of gender resentment or backlash against feminism is fueling right-wing political movements.
Yeah, yeah. And I can, my view about this, this is where I think a lot of people on the progressive side of the argument will disagree with me, which is that I don't see in that, at this point, a resurgence of misogyny, banty women. At this point, I think what's happened is that the neglect of these real problems that many men are facing has created a real vacuum. And yeah. and I think that generally, and I think there are many other areas where this is true, I think problems become grievances when they're neglected by people in positions of power, right? I think a yeah. neglected problem becomes a grievance. And so like, the trick is to not neglect the problem. So, yeah. so if there's a real issue and you're not addressing it, it's not being seen to be being addressed by you know those in a position to address it, then I think it does curdle into a grievance. And then those grievances are absolutely fuel to the fire of reactionary and in many cases pretty far-right forces, because they actually correctly identify that there are problems here and then incorrectly blame that on, say, women or the women's movement, etc. But that, mm-hmm. in the absence of another narrative, actually, that it's, I think that story can be quite a compelling one, especially to men who are really, really struggling and who don't feel seen and who don't feel heard and who don't feel as if actually advocating for themselves, or that there are voices saying, you know what, men are really struggling right now. That's just not a permissible thing to say. Well, of course, someone's going to come along and exploit that.
And one other word I would add to your list is they don't feel respected.
I completely agree.
Yeah.
Right. And that's, isn't that like the ultimate, in a way, the social harm is to sort of feel disrespected. And it comes back a little bit to this conversation we had a moment ago about, you know, toxic masculinity and this kind of pathologization. It's like, if you really want someone to lean into a part of their identity, then what you do is pathologize it. You problematize it. You make it right. So if you really want men to start being quite assertive and performative about their masculinity, start calling it toxic. And then you will absolutely get the sort of reaction that you can get from people now. And I think that's human nature, isn't it? So like, look, it's a bit of a screw you moment, which is like, in that case, I'm doubling down on this identity, which you're telling me is so bad.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So let's get into, because I think, you know, I'm in sync with your thinking, probably 75%.
But
there's a 25%. You'll take it. There's a 25% where I think we have a different emphasis. So talking about how we got here, at one point, I think it was in a video that's on your website, which I commend to people, American Institute for Boys and Men. You say we are in danger of getting into a downward spiral where boys are raised in broken families, then they are not able to thrive, and then they repeat the cycle. And you say we're in danger. I think we're already there. And I think that that is part of what we are seeing, is that boys are struggling because, as we referred to at the earlier in this conversation, one of the things that has become clear from the social science in the last few years is that growing up in a single parent family does not affect boys and girls the same way. It is much harder on boys to grow up without. It's bad for both. I mean, it's definitely bad for both sexes. Girls who grow up without their dads are much more likely to have teen pregnancies and a variety of other pathologies, problems. But overall, it is much more damaging to boys to grow up without dads than girls. And they're much more less likely to be ambitious and to graduate from high school and be employed and all of those things that are important. And they're much less likely to grow up to be the kind of men that women want to marry if they themselves didn't grow up in a home with dads. And you, I think, have said, you recognize this, you talk about it, but you say, what we need to do is reintegrate men into their children's lives. But you are reluctant, I think, to say that we need to double down on strengthening marriage.
Correct.
Okay, so let's talk about that, because I am very skeptical that you can get men to be engaged fathers if they're not attached to the mothers of their children.
Yeah, well, in some ways, I think this is the billion-dollar question, if we were to put it in numeric terms, because so where we agree is that engaged, responsible fatherhood, the men, fathers in the lives of children, but especially boys, is hugely important, right? And that fatherlessness is a massive social problem.
Right? Yeah,
agree there. And so I think then what we're doing is thinking, we're arguing about how men are integrated into the lives of their children. And you're arguing that in practice, the way that happens is through marriage and through a sustained commitment to not only to the children, but to the mother as well, as a family unit, right? And that husband and father is essentially there's a sort of redundancy in there, right? They just go together, right? They're bundled together. And what I'm arguing is that in the new world of economic independence for women, where women can, to quote Gloria Steinem, can choose marriage rather than being forced into it, that we're in a very different world where, in fact, many fathers are going to have to be engaged in their children's lives, even if they are not romantically attached to the mother. And the worst of all worlds is to have a society where we say the way for men to be attached to children is through marriage, but then we see the atrophying of marriage, especially for lower income Americans, right? I think we can agree that's the worst of all worlds, right? Either your world or my world is better than what we've currently got. And I think the question is, like, does your world, the world back to marriage, let's call it that, world, or my world, which is the forward to fatherhood outside of marriage in many cases, offer the best prospects for progress? I think that's Is that a fair assessment of the nature of our argument? And here's, I think the nice thing about this argument is we agree about the ends. We really just think about the talking about the means. And that I don't think either of us would be heartbroken were either of us to be successful.
Absolutely.
Like if there was a world where you could get responsible and engaged fatherhood outside of the traditional way that happens with through marriage, I think you'd be saying, good. Right?
Yes.
You might still be in favor of marriage for other reasons, and so would I. But
yeah.
And likewise, if I said, look, we see a return to marriage, and we see many, many more men and women choosing to have children together, choosing to be married, engaged in their kids' lives, I'd be thrilled too. Right. So what we're really having is just a question of like which is the most likely and which is the most tractable. And for my money, given the trends as they already are, with most children to non-college educated parents, and I think this is a very important class distinction, which you, of all people, know a lot about. You've written a lot about this. Most of those kids are born outside marriage now. Right?
Yeah.
That's the norm. Right?
Mm-hmm.
70% of black kids are born outside marriage. And so if for everybody outside of the college educated class, and particularly for black families, non-marital childbearing is now the norm, right? Then I worry a lot that the you have to be married message benches most of our fathers in that group, right? We've said you've already failed. And that in practice, they are probably not going to get back together with the mother. They may not have intended to have children with the mother, which is why I'm a big proponent of access to effective contraception, but that's a different conversation. And so, of course, I want more responsible fatherhood. And I will say one more thing on this, which is, and I will say that fatherhood promotion policies show more signs of efficacy than marriage promotion policies. And even Melissa Carney in her book, The Two-Parent Privilege, is very honest about that. She's like, the marriage promotion policies just didn't really, it's very hard to promote marriage through policy, but actually you might do better at how do we help non-resident fathers? How do we reform child support? How do we reform child welfare? How do we help incarcerated? There's just more to go at from a policy point of view. And I will say that my hope is that if fathers are convinced about their importance of their role, and I would say their moral responsibility to be in their kids' lives and to be fathers, I suspect that would increase marriage. Because that's actually mostly how you're going to do that, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that my push for more responsible and engaged fatherhood is quite likely to result in more marriage. I'm not sure it would go the other way around.
Okay, that's interesting. So first, I want to tell a quick story. One of the nicest stories that I ever saw on the TV news concerned a school in Louisiana, mostly black kids, where they were having a lot of truancy problems and a lot of behavior issues. And, you know, the school disciplinarian, the vice principal or whatever, was having difficulty coping with, and it was mostly the boys who were misbehaving, of course, it usually is. And what they did is they brought in these dads from the community to just hang out at the school, to be there before the bell rang in the morning, to be there at the lunchroom, to hang out, tell dad jokes, just be present. And they had a dramatic turnaround in behavior, not just the kids whose dads were actually there, but from all the kids. Just the presence of the men being there and just being dad-like was enough to turn around that whole school. Now, as somebody who believes so strongly in the importance of father figures and that kind of positive masculine role modeling, this won't surprise you at all. I mean, I'm sure you know about this story. But I would also point out that just based on what we have seen over time of the way men who get separated from their wives behave toward their children, I'm skeptical about the maintaining that bond absent the marriage. So, for example, as I said in my book, the tie between mothers and children is like iron. Nothing separates it. You know, divorce, whatever. No, unless the mother has severe mental illness, she's going to be attached to those kids. Fathers, less so. When fathers get divorced, and I know you have this data in your book too, 10 years after a divorce, 2/3 of kids have not seen their fathers in a year. There are lots of examples, lots of data showing that after a marriage dissolves, especially if the dad gets involved with a new woman, which is mostly what happens, the attachment to his own biological kids from a previous relationship or previous marriage attenuates a lot more than women's connection to their kids. And that, I think, is a reason to stress trying to keep marriages intact, trying to keep that bond, the nuclear family, trying to keep it strong. Because as we see, when it dissolves, the relationships between men and their kids tends to be attenuated.
Yeah, so maybe a middle ground here is to say that I think we could certainly agree that everything else equal, much easier and better to be raising kids as the biological parents, I guess, with the carve out that you're going to now get some same sex and certainly some adoptive. Yes. And IVF, et cetera.
I'm an adoptive parent myself. Yay, right. Adoption.
So I think it's important that sort of with that, you know, important caveat. That it's just easier and therefore better. It's much easier to be an engaged parent if you're like with them 100% of the time, and especially to have those, you know, unscripted moments, the day-to-day moments, some family scholar, and I've forgotten who it was, I apologize to them now, we talk about quality time, but actually what you need as kids is what they call garbage time. I can't Absolutely. Remember who said that, but it was like just the kind of, you know, raking, cleaning out the garage time.
Exactly.
Right? Just like, it's just,
I know,
like,
the idea that you're going to schedule quality time with children, as you know, as a parent, is not
like,
going to work.
No, I mean, one of the worst terms is like, it, puts, it makes you feel so bad as a parent because you're like, is this quality time? You know, and usually the answer is no. So I think we can agree that. But I think if we recognize that, like, we're certainly not going to see overnight a huge reduction in the number of non-resident parents or parents who are separated, I think that we absolutely doing our best by them is not in conflict with any claim that people won't want to make about other things equal, better to stay together. The thing right. is, Mona, that I don't think that many people disagree with you, including the separated parents themselves, right? It's not that many people go into this thinking, you know what, my dream is have kids with someone I barely know, try and live together, doesn't work, end up just, you know, estranged from my kids. That's no one's life dream is to be like an estranged parent. It happens to people. But I don't think that as a normative description, there are that many people for who set out to be this is kind of a, I think it happens in the way that life happens. But I will say one more thing. I do think that the social science about engaged fatherhood and relationships, which you're right, we both share, is like, it's on your side of this argument. I'm just going to cede that it's quite clear historically and from the social science that the chances of dads remaining engaged post a separation, relationship dissolving, are nowhere near what we need them to be. Right? I completely agree. And all the evidence points to like much, much higher chance of engaged fatherhood within the intact family. Completely agree. I just don't know how to go back. Right.
Yeah. So you're saying we've got all these dads now who aren't married to their kids' mom, and how do we get their relationships back on track with their kids? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. It's and that was still going to be more of them. Look, I don't. I mean, we've seen the divorce rate actually stabilize, but that's I think for selection effect. But
Yeah, it's also because many more people are not marrying in the first place.
Yeah, and that's so I think that's right. It's partly about there's a lot of them there. Secondly, because there are still going to be more of them. And so it's a bit, I suppose my response to your criticism, which I think is the most, probably one of the most telling criticisms against my position. I just want to say that first of all. And I think I could really be wrong about this, is that I fear in your position that the perfect might be becoming the enemy of the good in the current social context, which we can't wave away, right? We have to live in the world as it is. And I worry that the kind of marital ideal, even if ideal, is so far away from the lives of so many people now. They think that it is. But I want to say one more thing, right? Here's my, like, I don't think you can elide divorce and separation anymore. I actually think that those are now very, very distinct phenomenon. And actually, I think that the evidence for fathers post-divorce remaining engaged with their kids is getting better all the time. And that actually you'll see, like, mostly joint custody. Fathers now post-divorce spend about a third of the time with kids now, right? That is a completely different world. But I think that's because of a selection effect. I think that the people who are marrying before having their children are the kinds of people who are wanting to be engaged with their children and wanting that to be through marriage, but in the unfortunate event that the marriage ends, remain committed to their children. For other people who are not married, who are either cohabiting or in many cases, I think it's a completely different world. And I think that the evidence there for ongoing fatherhood involvement is much, much worse. So in some ways, I might be making a kind of argument for you, which is that actually marriage still seems to be doing some of its work, at least in terms of signaling commitment and intent, even once the marriage has dissolved. And so I actually think it's very important that we separate what's happening to divorced parents and what's happening to non-married parents who separate, even if they were together in the first place, because some of them were never together.
Right. We unfortunately, Andrew Cherlin has observed, we have in America the dubious distinction of having the least stable unions of anybody in the world. We couple and uncouple more promiscuously, if you will, than any other country. And it's not as if these are just adolescent flings. People move in together, they have a kid, they move out, there's never a marriage, there's never a relationship. And children and this tends to be among poor and lower middle class kids for the most part, they grow up in very chaotic situations. Let me say a word about why I don't think it is not achievable to reinstitute the marriage ideal. Okay. People say, well, it hasn't been shown to work. I don't really feel it's been tried. I think the messages in our culture are very individualistic, that you marry for love, that if it's not working out, there's always divorce, that it's better to come from a broken home than to live in one. These are all the messages that people get. And in fact, there's a lot of, again, falling back on social science data, but the fact is that when there have been studies that have looked at unhappy couples, even seriously unhappy couples with, you know, problems of alcoholism, betrayal, all kinds of, you know, serious problems, where they have stayed together and worked on their problems. 5 years after the initial intake, if they've stayed together, they are happier than the people who divorced. And so people don't know that. They don't know the data that you can be extremely unhappy in a marriage and get through it and come out the other end, not divorced, but married and happier. I envision a different approach where instead of saying, let's try to invent a way of And I'm, don't get me wrong, I'm all for efforts to integrate men into the lives of their kids, whatever it takes, of course, because we know how important that is for kids' welfare. I'm just dubious that it will be successful in the absence of that pair bonding by the parents. And I would love to see a movement, not so much government policy, but a social and cultural movement, maybe led by Barack Obama, who's been incredibly articulate and passionate about this issue, about the importance of marriage, the importance of a commitment to your kids. Let people know that it's not easy, that there are going to be times where you're going to be unhappy. Don't expect it. Don't tell a story about marriage being this fairy tale where you know, put a ring on a finger and then all is well. No, that it's work, that it can be very, very trying, but that it's worth it in the end to put the effort in. Those are the kinds of messages that I think as a cultural matter would be helpful in stemming this movement that we have seen. And let me just say one other thing. And you mentioned it before, but I want to stress this because I keep coming back to the importance of, you know, people who say we cannot go back. It's just the train has left the station. The fact is, the upper third of our society, the college educated elite, if you will, they are living the life of like the 1950s. They are getting married and staying married. They are doing those things. And it's not that women in this class are dependent economically on their husbands. These are the women who are the least likely to be dependent economically on their husbands. These are the most egalitarian marriages, and they are very successful. And a lot of the problems that boys and men are experiencing in our society are not experienced by the college educated at all.
Yeah. Well, this is great. I'm really enjoying this. I completely agree with your assessment of what's happening on the surface of college educated parents. You did mention they're very egalitarian, those relationships. And actually, I wrote an essay for The Atlantic a few years back now, and the title on it was How to Save Marriage in America. So you would have loved the title, if not all of the content. But actually, in that, I actually made this point that you do see this huge class difference. And in order to understand marriage in America today, and it is a bit different in other countries, is that you have to understand that the most economically powerful women in the history of the world, i.e. American women today, are choosing to marry.
Correct.
Which is against the predictions of the feminist movement to an order of magnitude. It's almost impossible to comprehend. This is supposed to be the other way around.
Right.
It's supposed to be the opposite of that. And so I think to understand, like, why would it be that these incredibly economically powerful, socially skilled, you know, awesome women are choosing to marry? Well, it's because, as I think you've indicated, this is not their grandmother's marriage or possibly even their mother's marriage. And so I came to believe, and I wrote this in the Atlantic piece, is that I see these as kind of, I call them high investment parents. It's high investment parenting. And so I believe that one of the highly educated Americans want to raise their kids well. They want to invest in their kids. And they want to have kids with somebody that they want to raise their kids with. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think that that desire to parent well and to be successful co-parents is a big driver of marriage among more educated marriage. It's no longer economic dependence. It's no longer so it's something else. And I think it could be some of the soulmate stuff and all that. But I think a lot of it is just like college educated Americans typically get married before they have their kids, which means, more importantly than almost anything else, they meant to have kids with that person and try to raise their kids together with that person, right? That's so much.
Yeah.
And so at that point, this is Cherlin's thing about marriage as a capstone. At this point, it's sort of both signaling and solidifying the commitment to have children together and raise children together. And so I think what's happening there is that the joint commitment of the parents to parent well and together gets expressed through marriage. So if everybody had decided that they want to parent deliberately and well and together, I think that would seriously increase marriage. I think that the problem is what happens on the way to that, right? It's very interesting. There's this data, I know you love the social science as much as I do, but like showing that, like, even among, if you look at college educated parents who weren't married when they had the first child, right, they're almost always married by the time they have the second. Mm-hmm. So it's just that they just slightly fluffed the timing, right? But they were clearly going to get married. Do you know what I mean? It's like, so it, like, technically that child's born out of wedlock. You might look at it and say, oh, it's a shotgun wedding. No. That is not what it is. This is like, this is a couple who had decided to have children together, live together, build a life together, get married, have children. It's just that something went wrong. Maybe COVID came along or something, right? I think it's happened a bit around COVID, which is that some of them that they, and in that sense, it doesn't matter that the marriage, to most people anyway, that the marriage came afterwards, because it was the commitment. Mm-hmm. It's the commitment. But I think it's now as much the commitment to raise kids together that's driving marriage. And so I think that engaged parenting is a pro-marriage policy. And I think a lot of people on the other side are arguing that marriage is a pro-parenting policy. And I now, when I observe the upper middle class, I see parenting being a very strong part of their incentives now around marriage.
And when you look at people from less advantaged backgrounds, what you find is that they don't have that life script. Nobody around them is married. If they know about marriage at all, they think that it is, you know, the capstone after you've done a lot of other things, or that they think it's for other people. They don't connect it to the importance of raising kids. They think they're completely different issues, being married and having children. And they're unaware of the social science data showing that if they get a full-time job, wait until they're married to have children, and stay, you know, with their partner, that their chances of being in poverty and their kids' chances of being in poverty are radically, radically reduced.
I mean, and full-time work is doing a lot of the work in that.
Well,
equation.
That's You're true, right. but here's what, you know. So you say, what do you do? I understand what you're saying. You know, like, well, okay, but what do you do now? Because we've already gone so far down this path, and I guess so. I don't know. But I'm guessing that wouldn't it be great if there were a social movement akin to the movement for gay marriage, where you change hearts and minds about what this, you know, what the ideal is, and you focus on getting people to think through, getting the message to young people. Like, I would teach, tell me what you think about this. Should we teach the success sequence to kids in high school? Just teach them that the thing I just mentioned, that if you, you know, finish high school, get a job, get married before you have kids, that you will radically increase your chances of living a middle-class life. Should we teach that?
So my view is no, and I'll explain
why.
Okay. Although I just want to give a quick plug to Patrick Brown, has a really nice piece for the Ethics and Public Policy Center.
Where I used to be, yeah.
Your alma mater, or however you put it, on attitudes in 5 Sunbelt states towards different family policies, which came out last in 2024. And interestingly, the idea of teaching that success sequence you just described, it, they polled this, was, I think it might have been the most popular one among Republican parents. And these were Southern states, so they were more Republican. And I don't think made it to the top 5 of Democrats. So it's a very, you know, very ideological question. But what I've discovered is, for me anyway, it's the marriage, being married before you have children bit. That I struggle with, because I think in practice there are so many who won't have experienced that, won't be able to do that, And because I don't think that's what's doing the work in the equation. I think that what's doing the work in the equation is, like, finish high school, hard to argue with that. Get a full-time job, hard to argue with that. It's the get married before you have kids point that I think is the difficult one, because for me, it slightly misidentifies where things go wrong. And this comes back to the conversation we're just having, which is it that people no longer value marriage, aspire to marriage, etc.? And I don't think it's that. That's why I don't think the analogy with same-sex marriage quite works, because there are a lot of people who are against same-sex marriage and then had to be, were persuaded otherwise. Not everybody, of course, but it's more that they feel like it's unobtainable, or that it's oversold, or that it's that they'll never find anyone good enough for it, or it's a nice idea. But like, and so where I see the problem occurring is, and this is Isabel Sawhill's work at Brookings, in some of her work, Generation Unbound and so on, is that she calls to describes the people who kind of plan their way into parenthood. I don't think she used that language actually, but and those who drift into it. And I think it's the bit that's missing from this conversation very often is the kind of, what does it take to make a kid, to make a child? And it is a fact that most of the children born inside marriage are intended, as you would expect, hopefully. But most of the children born outside marriage were not intended. Right, this is an accident of one kind or another. Now, the data on that is very complicated, and it's like, but nonetheless, this is like, this was not the plan, right? And so I think it's that sort of sometimes not very well thought through drifting into parenting with someone who you perhaps didn't necessarily select as your life partner. I think that's where a lot of the problem occurs, and so I think that it comes, you know, further up. It's further upstream in a sense. And that's why I find it interesting that many of the conservatives who are so concerned about marriage are very reluctant to talk about access to contraception, because I think that for different reasons. But I think that in some ways borders, in my view, and I risk offending people with this, but borders on the naive given the current situation that we're in, right? Because we're actually ending up asking people to say, look, not only should you get married before you have kids, but you shouldn't have sex before you get married. And that does seem like a pretty difficult clock to turn back, frankly, especially given that huge number of the people who got married in the 60s actually did get pregnant before they got married, and there were shotgun marriages. So I don't know.
Actually, even among the Puritans, they used to, it was common to be pregnant when they were married, they got married.
Yeah. So but, I guess I don't know if that's a ship has sailed type thing. I don't know how you respond to that. I know that was a ramble, but
no, I mean, there's a lot there. It is hard to get people to plan. That's why stigma used to do a lot of this work. You know,
pro-social shame is how someone put it recently.
Yes, exactly. And you know, it had its advantages as well as disadvantages, but I don't think that that's possible to return to. I've already said what I think we ought to do. So let's talk though about some of these other proposals that you have about connecting dads with their kids more. The policy changes that you'd like to see, and we'll end there on your on your positive proposals.
Yeah. Well, so I want to say something about your beautiful image earlier of the father figures in boys' lives, even if their own fathers are not, for one reason or another. And so I do think, like, it takes a village, but some of the villagers have to be dads. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the role of men generally in boys' lives is very important. And I think that, you know, many of us as men have ended up as kind of social fathers, is sometimes the term, to other people's kids for one reason or another. But I also think it's one of the reasons why I'm borderline obsessed with reversing the decline in the share of male teachers. I think that men in the classroom, I think it can be huge. So we've dropped the share of K-12 male teachers from 33% to 23% in the last couple of decades, and it's going down and down and down. And actually, here's something I think we could agree on, which is, like, if you are going to see this decline in the share of kids who've got fathers in their lives, that would be about the worst time ever to be emptying the men out of the classroom.
Yeah.
Right. That's precisely the time you'd want that number to go the other way. And also because men in teaching tend to be coaches. They tend to coach boys' sports, etc. And I think the role of coach is almost iconic in many places. Again, there it takes a village. So I just want to say all that. And actually, it's very striking to me and very saddening to me that organizations like the YMCA, Big Sisters, Big Brothers, and the Boys and Girls Clubs of America reliably report a lack of male volunteers. They have so many more women than men. But many of the people they're trying to serve are boys. And so I do think that for men to sort of step up into those pro-social roles is massively important. And then fathers, I'm in favor of paid leave for fathers. The US military at last in 2023 introduced leave for fathers and for mothers. They each now get 3 months of paid leave. And I think that's a very powerful signal that fathers matter. I think that it should be dedicated and we should send a signal that mums get time, but so do dads. And then I also think that, and here I am not quite ready to make quite such prescriptive comments because I'm still figuring this out, but the way in which the child welfare system interacts and the child support systems interact with each other and with men who are not married, it's clearly suboptimal. Catherine Eden's work is very good on this. And so I think that whilst the divorce courts are mostly working pretty well, and actually the American Institute for Boys and Men is just publishing a paper on this from June Carbon, whose work you might know, and her co-authors, saying, look, we don't have a very family-friendly system for couples who are not going through the divorce courts, who weren't married in the first place. And in particular, it's very anti-father. Mm-hmm. And so we bench many of our dads through the way in which we legally handle separation, child support, etc., for men. And so I'm not exactly sure what the best proposals are. Different states are trying different things. It's something I want to work on. But I'm quite sure right now that we are not serving men very well. And we are very often inadvertently sending a message to men that they matter as walking ATMs. We need your child support, but the other stuff about actually being in your kids' lives, oh, that's someone else's department. In this case, literally somebody else's department, rather than being part of an integrated system. So I think we're really, even in a world, which you would love to see more marriage, in a world where there are at least some fathers who are not married to their mothers, which as I say right now is a lot, our legal systems are failing them very badly. So we need more of a father-friendly family law system too.
I guess one last thing I would say is that I would love for more men to feel appreciated for their fatherhood role, because it is, the more we learn about how poorly children do without dads, the more we learn about the unique ways that fathers parent.
Yes.
And it is something that was interesting to me to research that it kind of comes naturally, but it's very important that men tend to do more rough and tumble play with their kids.
Yep.
That they are more encouraging of their children to
take risks
than moms. Yeah. Moms are more protective. Again, these are generalizations and there's a lot of overlap.
They're at the average, but that's right. I mean, actually, I didn't put this in my book, but when I was working on my book, I would walk my dog around our neighborhood in the mornings. And almost every day I would see this father with his kids. He had two kids and they had there was this wall that got progressively higher.
Mm-hmm.
And he would have them go up the wall and jump off the wall and he would catch them. And then each day they went a little bit higher until they were hurling themselves off this like 7-foot wall into their father's arms and squealing with delight as they were doing it.
Yeah.
And I was kind of watching this and I got to know him a little better. And I just thought, mums wouldn't do that.
Right.
And I do think there's something beautiful about the different things we can bring to the party. And the evidence now is really clear that dads matter. They matter in many ways that overlap with mums and are complement, not where we're interchangeable, but they also matter in some ways that are unique and distinct. And I think that the message that dads matter, that you matter to your kids, is the most important one. And then you and I can argue have other arguments about how and marriage and policy and stuff. But I think that that central message that that you are uniquely contributing to your kids' lives, and that if there is nothing else, that's hugely important. I will tell you one story that really affected me. When I write about fatherhood in my book, I'm largely talking about outcomes for kids, which we started part of this conversation with. And this father came up to me afterwards, who was in the queue of people just to chat to me after I'd given this talk. And a middle-aged guy, working class, I think we're in Wisconsin, and he has tears rolling down his face. And he says, I like your work, I love what you said, but I have a problem with what you said. You said dads matter because their kids will do better, they'll get better GPA or kind of whatever. And he said, well, that might be true, but I got to tell you, being a dad is literally all I have in my life right now. Oh, and so he said, what I didn't hear you say is anything about why being a dad matters for dads.
Oh, that's so good. Yes.
I didn't say that. And I thought, and not only is that like wrong in terms of social science, because there's huge evidence that being a father is better for your own health, your own, but yeah. Also it's like, that's not how I experienced fatherhood. I didn't measure myself, you know, it's part of my identity now. And so yes. I think that kind of honoring not only the activities of fathers, which is kind of huge, but also just the very identity of being a father, because there are so many men out there right now who may be struggling economically, struggling with their health, but by God, they're still a father, and therefore yes. they are precious to us.
Yes. To kids. Oh, that is such a great story and a great note to end on. Thank you, Richard Reeves, so much for joining me today.
Thank you, man. That was great. Okay.